in case we were not being recorded before, which I always question if that's actually the case. How can we not have been being recorded and now we are? But in case you felt like you weren't being recorded before, we are now being recorded. Please sign in.
It's 7:05. Do you know where your karma is?
Ooh. So, Dan, have we got people live over there?
We do. We have at least 5 signed in.
That's good to know. We're going to launch at this point the 5th Sunday sermon, in my opinion, is the only thing you need to know if you really want to make a difference as far as this particular section of the teaching goes. And I think there is probably good reason for everybody to read along with us, and then if we have the time, we will read it to you, and you can just listen. But for now, if you have your own copy of the book, share in the reading along. And, you know, there is one over there. You could probably borrow that one right up there and read along with. So, the 5th Sunday sermon, 5. Man can only become the master of his own spiritual destiny to the degree that matter and energy lose their sense of reality to him and their power over him.
As he enters into a more and more divine spiritual he will comprehend the reason that a spiritual being can heal the sick, raise the dead, and restore the spirit that has been lost within another.
It is because all reality, all creation, is pure spirit. There is no reality to matter and energy or to the suffering and efforts of the world of matter. There is no reality to space, time, matter, or energy other than as pure spirit. This realization alone is enough to give the spirit the power to work the miracles of the spirit.
Not really miraculous to the spirit, because they simply reflect the spiritual being's control and understanding over matter, space, energy, and time of the material world, and the suspension or non-belief of the belief that the material universe is anything other than pure spirit. That is why the spirit has the power to be the source and the cause of any form or any action of an object or a life form within the world of matter.
We never see the spiritual beings described in the Holy Scriptures making a reality out of a disease or a death in order to alter the condition. They never ask the nature of the disease or the cause of death. They simply cure the disease or raise the dead.
The master of spiritual beings never gives blood or wonders whether the individual ought to live or die. He just fixes it. That's all. The nature of the man of spirit is that he has the power to make things go wrong.
To understand humanity, which is spirit, which is altogether itself God, in eternity and infinity, is to understand that man does not have two lives or three lives, but is in fact an indestructible process of reality, always remaining in the state of pure spirit, regardless of what is apparently happening within him or proceeding around him.
What use is medicine and science to the infinite eternal spirit? Why try to cure the spirit with the methods of the body?
That completes the first reading of the fifth Sunday sermon. This time, when we read it, if you don't need to be looking at your TV screen or looking at your book or putting your attention on something else, maybe you can get yourself into a slightly more relaxed posture, maybe just dropping the facial mask a little bit, you know, just a little tiny bit of relaxation. And then just hear the sound of the voice reading the words of the sermon as if the Spirit is speaking in the sound that you most understand.
The fifth Sunday sermon. To the degree that matter and energy lose their sense of reality to him and their practical work.
As he enters into a more and more divine spiritual existence, he will comprehend the reason that a spiritual being can heal the sick, raise the dead, and restore the spirit that has been lost within another.
It is all creation is pure. There is no reality to matter and energy, or to the suffering and efforts of the world of matter. There is no reality to space, time, matter, or energy, other than as pure spirit. This realization alone is enough to give the spirit the power to work. The miracles of the Spirit.
All miracles performed in the world of matter are not really miraculous to the Spirit, because they simply reflect the spiritual being's control and understanding over matter, space, energy, and time of the material world, and the suspension or non-existence of the belief that the material universe is anything other than pure spirit. That is why the Spirit has the power to be the source and the cause of any form or any action of an object or a life form within the world of matter.
You never see the spiritual beings described in the Holy Scripture, making a reality out of a disease or death in order to alter the condition. They never ask the cause of the disease or the cause of death. They simply cure the disease or raise the dead.
the master of spiritual beingness never gives drugs or wonders whether the individual ought to live or die. He just fixes it. That's all. The nature of the man of spirit is that he has the power to make things go right.
To understand humanity, which is all together with self God in eternity, is to understand that man does not have two lives or three lives, but is in fact an indestructible process of reality, always remaining in a state of pure spirit, regardless of what is apparently happening within him and proceeding around him.
What use is medicine and science to the infinite and eternal spirit? Why try to cure the spirit with the methods of the body? This completes this reading of the fifth Sunday sermon.
So, right, if I make a personal
note. I think now's the time.
I just want to say that sort of the basis of this teaching is really what influenced my clinical practice. Because at some point, you know, after being exposed to this teaching in the various forms that EJ presented, I began to realize that when I would be, well, let me back up. Maybe it didn't ruin my clinical practice, but it certainly shook the hell out of it. Because I would be sitting with some clients or family, and I would be listening to their problems, and I would, you know, be sort of sympathizing and helping the problem. And at some point it struck me that I was confirming their beliefs in those problems. And the more earnest I was, fear, in a sense, it kind of locks them into that. I remember after one month of Pennsylvania, we spent a lot of time talking about this, that we had to suddenly change the way that we approached being able to work with others, and began really, that's when I really began working with the idea of whatever presented to myself, if I saw depression or anger or hopelessness, I had to work on those conditions within myself. Mm-hmm. So that was the only place that I could work. And we kind of covered a little bit of that a couple of weeks ago. But it did completely change my whole investment.
And so much for that career.
Yes, so much. I became a librarian.
much more useful skill. Keep those books from rotting.
But we have Mary here, who has worked for a number of years in the medical. Did you have any thoughts about how you've been teaching?
You have to hand here the phone.
Oh, is the phone it's on?
Yeah, you just talk.
Talk. Just talk. Yes. certainly, I have found EJ's teachings very helpful in my nursing career, especially dealing with dying people. I didn't feel fearful, so I think I could help emit a kind of a calm acceptance for them and not buy into their angst, like you're saying with your situation. I thought you put that very well, actually. So I guess I tried to sort of show people there was another way to perceive life and death, and in a big general way, of course. I mean, I had to be tactful, of course, but sort of feel it out with people, ask questions, or you get a sense pretty fast, actually, if they're wanting to look more than this reality. And in fact, for some people, I would give them the clear light invocation. And one woman was so thrilled. I had blown it up for her, and she called it her poem. And her brother was dying of cancer in his 40s, and she put it up on the wall in his room and said, "I'm so happy I have this poem up." You know, and we didn't really talk a lot about what it all meant. She just liked it; just worked for her. So it's the same sort of. We can let those teachings seep in to other realities and in a helpful way. And like I said at the beginning, I know it helped me. I would say a few prayers on the way, or may this effort be for the benefit of all beings everywhere, before I went in. And I just felt I was coming from a better place than I used to before I knew EJ's teachings.
Medicine will fail,
and the only one who will not fail is the practitioner.
Mm-hmm. Very get that.
And you know, the word that comes up when you say that, that I learned because I'm involved in hospice as well, is companioning. If you can companion someone while they're dying, then you can't fix it, but you're there with them, present with them. And then they just know, they sense just that feeling that someone is there with them. It's quite powerful, isn't it? I'm sure you've seen that.
Mm-hmm. For me, that's a good term, because it was like when I had a midwife, you know, you're going through very intense surgical phases. Probably some really fear, you're in that space. But it really makes a difference if there is somebody who is there contending.
Hold on a second here. Are you still on the phone, online with us, Silverdale?
Yes, Pat, I'm still online with you. I went on mute there. I'm having trouble hearing what you're saying, so I put it on mute and listen for my audio.
Just speak up a little bit more here so that people can hear through this.
And I'm just curious, who is this that's sharing from her experience as a companion nurse?
Mary Donald is with us today. She and Jim have arrived from British Columbia.
Oh, wonderful. Welcome, Mary and Jim. Mm-hmm.
It's George.
George, are you just south of us in the States, I think?
In Seattle.
Oh, yeah, that's not too far.
I don't see a volume here. I think the volume is on the machine in your hand.
Well, and I'll tell you, Pat, I've had no problem with whatever you say right into the phone, but Tamara, when you turn, you must turn your head or something, and you completely fade out. So, just
fade
comment.
Out. Okay. I'll try to keep the ice cream mic in front of my face. Is that better?
Yeah, that's perfect. Whatever you're doing right now is working.
All right.
Yes, George, you're much Silverdale. You're much more volume to you
you're
now.
Tuning into the frequency.
Yeah, we got it now.
Okay,
so,
very good.
Silverdale, in terms of your the progressive nature of these sermons and how we've come in the last 2 weeks from, you know, being inside the chambers and traveling through the journey, and now we're stepping outside of that and taking a look at these sermons, where do you place this fifth Sunday sermon in that process, given that we've now spent 3 weeks looking at 1, 2, 3, and 4, and this is the fifth? How do you see that?
Well, you know, look at for me, these sermons happen to be particularly timely because I think I'm beginning to be able to identify personal experiences with the words that I'm reading. And in reading each of these sermons, what we're hearing, this is really not unlike, to my way of thinking, this is not unlike the books that we're studying, which is to say, it's the same message repeated in a different form so that it seems like it's different, but it's actually exactly the same thing, which is what we're trying to do, which is develop our essential self so that it becomes the center of our gravity of perception, in which case we perceive objective reality, which is the spirit. But that's a property of the development of our essential self. And so what we're all striving to do is develop our essential self so that it becomes an independent perceiver of spirit. And in that case, gradually it becomes our master. And so as we read through this fifth sermon in particular, it's just reminding us that if our essential self is functioning, then we have the ability to perceive the reality that is being expressed here. And that whole process of perceiving by our essential self is a reflection of our awakening, very gradually over a long period of time. So kind of a long-winded answer to your question. But I think each of these books are saying exactly the same thing, but of course, they're different. Because they're different words, they seem to be, a different aspect of the same thing.
Perfect setup for me. Thank you so much.
Okay.
I was hoping you would lead into that little tricky word that you threw in your last phrase, awakening. And Tamara gave us some personally experienced relationship to this text, and so has Mary, and I am not going to be shy about it. I'm going to speak up my little piece.
Yay. You have the red hat.
I'm hoping that camera person is going to be willing to watch this absurd demonstration that I'm going to do. You? Ready? You'll be on your toes there, because I'm going to show something rather than talk so much about it. Talk when I finish.
Yeah.
No, you're gonna need that. Yeah, I know.
No, it's very slow.
Oh yeah, there's a mucho delay. But I'm not delaying. Don't. Don't worry, it's not going to be an issue. You don't need to worry about it. It's not going to be an issue. Now, 10 years ago, I had fourth stage cancer, chemo, and radiation. And I figured that survival was really good news. And so I wasn't asking for anything else. I had life, I had time, and I wasn't particularly damaged. So it came as a really, really, really big surprise about, I don't know, 5 weeks ago, 5 or 6 weeks ago, that I was starting to be able to do things with my form that hadn't occurred because of the results of the radiation and stuff. And I took a moment to think about my structure of life after cancer is good enough. Survival is good. And it never occurred to me that more was possible. It just hadn't been in the picture. So this statement here about spirit being possible to be the dominant characteristic rather than the, maybe you see it off to the shadow sometimes and you get a little hint. Maybe you switch the scale and the spirit is more dominant than you used to have it. You play that card in front of you all the time. That's more than recovery. That's restoration. I've got restoration of my form. I got a whole complete form with energy and enthusiasm and all that stuff. So the little physical demonstration there is an example of, I don't like to use the word spirit over matter because that's incorrect. It's all spirit. Where is your attention? And as George was saying, you wake up in moments, in another moment, and you have this tiny little window of opportunity to do what it says in the first sentence. Man can only become the master of his own spiritual destiny to the degree that matter and energy lose their sense of reality to him. That's, to me, that's the whole purpose of working in this way. And the previous four sermons have had some very specific instructions to practitioners and what the practitioner is called to do and how he must behave and what the significance of his understanding needs to be. And I thought it might be appropriate this evening to go from the discussion that's offered in the sermon into the practical activity of that office, that formulation called a practitioner. And since that's where I've spent the last 44 years, being a labyrinth practitioner, I thought I would share that with you because it seems it's something you might want to know about. So,
love to hear it.
What'd you say?
Love to hear it.
Love to hear it. Oh, thank you. Love to hear it. I'll love to speak it, too. So the Labyrinth Reader's Course is how we currently speak about this collection structure of exercises and opportunities to develop certain skills. It used to be called the Transit Practitioner's Course, and the reference was very specific that you were practicing behaving in a manner that a healthcare practitioner or a attorney practitioner of the law, you had a practice that you performed, and it had to do with the information that's available to beings about life and death. And the practitioner's course was designed to create the opportunity to discover what that would mean for you. Usually you do it in group, but not always. And the practitioner's course as a text has some very intriguing material, and I'll give you a small sample of that related to this fifth Sunday sermon. From lesson 6, called Refining Reader's Skills, and the reader is the one who is delivering the instructions from the Book of the Dead, this course, this book that we are working with now. And this exercise that's listed here, called Each Word a Universe, is an example of the type of practice, exercise, demonstration, whatever you want to call it, that allows you to step outside, even in a very small way, with a very small change. Purpose, to demonstrate that each word and phrase spoken in a labyrinth reading has a profound effect in the chamber and creates an entire universe. To develop this awareness, to improve the effectiveness of the labyrinth reader. Exercise. In ordinary life, there's that word again, life, we can get away with being insensitive. But in performing labyrinth reading, we must be aware of the effect of every action and word upon the space we are creating. To work with this reading, allow each word or phrase to resonate until its effect is complete before moving on to the next word or phrase. And I will give you an example of that from our fifth Sunday sermon. It. Is. Because. All. Reality all creation is a Spirit. End of sentence. End of demonstration. Notice the different spaces the reading passes through. Notice also in what way a given instruction or phrase leads to the need for the next instruction. So this is an example of the type of material that is offered in the course to develop the skill of being able to deliver the instructions from the American Book of the Dead. It is a practice. And the course helps you begin the practice. And that's all I have to say about it, but I will answer questions.
I wondered if you might just share, if you think it's appropriate, a little bit about the history, how it was tied in.
You got to keep your mouth over that microphone, or they can't hear you.
When we started reading the sermons, I said to Patricia, it reminded me quite a bit of a Christian mystic I had read called Joel Goldsmith. And in reading the sermons again, a little bit of Mary Eddy Baker. And you had a couple of observations about that that I wondered if you.
If I remembered.
Well, okay. Well, just that term practitioner was.
Yes, the Mary Baker Eddy, that's a Christian Science. That's a Christian Science thing. And the Christian Science practice is one where people who are the equivalent of either their doctor or minister in the Christian Science faith actually deliver what could be considered to be a remedy or a prescription in the form of passage in the Bible that what will assist your body or spirit in recovering from disharmony or distance from God or whatever is your perception is by reflecting upon certain passage in the Bible, which they will name for you to pay attention to. Yeah, it's a very, I think it's a very relevant to older, quote, primitive cultures, where it was more a reflection on things rather than let's change it.
Yeah, I was thinking a little bit about my grandmother, would work with the 23rd Psalm,
mm-hmm.
The Lord is my shepherd. And she would always recite it, but it seemed like when she was in different difficult situations, she would take one line out of it.
Right,
like
and
I had
just,
shared about
and
in
just
the presence
run it.
Of my enemy, and that
right.
would be the line that she would work with. And so,
right.
So it was really fascinating to me to hear that reading of the sermons or the reading of the scripture can be used for that realignment or
mm-hmm.
the restoration
mm-hmm.
To the spirit. So thank you for sharing.
Oh, you're welcome. I had forgotten about that.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have something somebody wanted to say with the phone there, sir?
There are a couple of comments in the chat. Grocky says, wow, this sermon number 5 has some amazing statements in it. That first sentence is such a powerful statement. Probably takes at least about a week or two to master.
Yes, thank you. At least a week or two. Maybe a week or two. Yeah, good. There is another aspect to the reason why I'm throwing in the information about the Labyrinth Reader's Course. One of the formulations around this teaching is the concept of the fourth way, as in not the direct way, not the one-pointed way, but a combination of all three, but actually the way of service as being the manner in which what is required for your transformation is required because you have placed yourself in the position of needing that in order to be of service. And in my opinion, there's nothing more easily accessed than the possibility of providing the delivery of instructions to a being who is going through transition. And especially since if you have the capacity to read and you have the willingness to read for another as if you were reading for yourself, and if you have the agreement with yourself that you are not only able and willing to do this, but you have the interest in doing this on behalf of another, that's really all that's required. The skill level, it grows. But the text that we're reading, the American Book of the Dead guidebook, has some amazing stuff, but it's like really intense. You notice? We're going into book 7 now, and already it's like, what's the next thing we're going to get hammered with in these chambers? And one of the means of absorbing some of that information is to be able to speak it aloud, to hear yourself speaking it while you're listening and while you're delivering it as if it is not just for you. And that makes a huge difference in your comprehension of what is being said or what you're reading. And Silverdale, I'm speaking to you, man. You tell me what's going on with this.
What's going on with this?
Yeah.
That's quite zen.
Good. Good for you. You're right with it here. Our discussion of the sermons in relation to the Labyrinth Reader's Course in the context of going through the American Book of the Dead guidebook chambers. Is that better than this?
Yeah, it's, wow. Look, the instructions as I understand them is that we want to develop our essential self, and in the process of doing that, we actually end up awakening our spirit. And in that awakening our own spirit, two things, to my way of thinking, two things are possible. One is, of course, we go through our own personal death while we're alive, and this is just a part of the die before you die. And if you're successful in that, then of course you can kind of create and choose a rebirth, a new identity, so to speak, while continuing to live your ordinary life. But in this case, as you're directing us as practitioners, Pat, is being able to do that successfully for somebody else because we've successfully done it for ourselves. We know what we're doing and why we're doing it, and the value and importance to the being of another. And in that sense, you know, we provide a service because there aren't many people that can do this kind of thing.
To me, the practice of working with the ABD and particularly working with this practitioner's guide, it really is this sense, and we talked about it in our group, there's a sense of moving from person to presence. When you, George, talk about the relationship between the human biological machine and the essence.
Damn, you know, talk into that microphone.
I'll try to. So for me, I translate a lot of what you're saying in my own experience is that this is a practice that leads from person into presence.
Tamara, if I could just interrupt you briefly. I love that. I love that formulation to transform ourselves from a person into a presence, because as I'm discovering in my own experience here, if we were able to the way this principle works is if we pacify to the degree that we're successful in pacifying our person, our presence actually automatically fills the void. And so
yes.
so much of the exercises we're doing or the various, you know, details of the teaching that we read is really directed toward to bring into harmony the three parts of our person, you know, our thinking, our feeling, our manifesting, to bring them together into a harmony of passivity, which automatically triggers our presence, and then we can begin to perceive reality as it really is, from the functionality of our essence, which is the basis for our presence, which is the cause of our development of personal beingness. So anyway,
well, I see, it goes back for me to the sermon 2, where it says that. When one is, let me just read it. It says, if the material world were compelled to stand before the truth of spirit, it would vanish. And that is, in fact, what does happen when the being who was matter but is now spirit stands before the truth. When he faces reality, his material body and mind vanish in an instant. So, you know, and then it continues that the work of the practitioner is knowing that this will happen, simply guides the deceased through the shock of this surprise. So, you know, for me, all of the, you know, the personality and the mind and the possessions, you know, they can fall away, they fail, but what's left is this presence. And when, you know, Patricia demonstrates, you know, to us, you know, that she's doing what appears to be a form, it's really, I have a tremendous sense of her presence that radiated. I think all of us sitting in this, where people are nodding their heads, when she was performing that, there was this overwhelming sense of presence that went so far beyond that physical body. So this practice helps us deal with that eventual shock that's going to occur to each of us.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. There's a preparation that we, you know, that we reference in a lot of the material that EJ presents, human biological machine as a transformational apparatus and practical work on self, and many of the other texts are really very much about get yourself together so that you can get into the work so that it can be of service. The ABD assumes that you're doing that, and it says, and this is your job. Mm-hmm. Pay attention in this way, be available in this manner, and, you know, this is what you need to do.
Right.
It's really very straightforward for me.
Yes. No, I agree.
So I want to close tonight's session with one more reference, which is from The Great Adventure, which, as I've said before, I am urging as our next text for this group. We have many, many, many more weeks to go with the American Book of the Dead guidebook, but I'm already looking at The Great Adventure as the place I'd like us to go. There is a talk of the month called The Deathbed Perspective. And I can't read all of it to you at the moment because we would be here for a while. It's in the Great Adventure, yes. Death is a part of life as much as birth and is as inevitable as eating, eliminating, sleeping, and breathing. The human body is going to breathe, and just as surely as it breathes, it's going to stop breathing. It is not something to be overcome or fought against. If you fight against death, you totally misunderstand the miraculous nature of life. Death is a miracle, and if life is beautiful, then death is equally beautiful. Be still and know. Not just know that thou art God, be still and know. All your questions will be answered. Stillness and silence. The speed of light is stillness and silence. Below the speed of light, everything moves. There's sound and there is movement. At the speed of light, there is no sound and there is no movement. Stillness and silence. Light in infinite extension. That's the saying, be still and know that thou art God. Or in the tradition of the space age, rotate the pod, please, Hal. The Hindus say you are the center of your own mandala. And in fact, we are all at the center of the universe. We are the centers of our own mandalas, and we share a common mandala. The one mandala is composed of many mandalai. That's why Al-Halaj could say, I am God. Not because he was ruler of the universe, but because he was permanently identified with the center. I am. This is what we call the man on the cross. We feel the cross, but the pain of being affixed to it quite quickly disappears, and we are left with only painless suffering and a feeling that something wonderful is about to happen, and it does. When the body dies, the same thing happens, except that if you haven't learned to be still and know, you'll still be turning with the body. If you are still rotating with the body, thinking you're the one in motion and the universe is still, you will experience the incredible wrenching sensation which gives death its bad reputation. But if you practice now, your death can be transformed from something horrible, sweetest embrace you have ever known. So that's where we're going to leave it this evening. Next Wednesday night, we will have our special guest, Lynn Larson, with us to discuss the writing of the Sunday sermons. And he will share that time with us in Crestline when these sermons were first being written and produced. So that's it for tonight. Thank you all for coming. I never asked, Dan, was there more comments? Okay, good.
And may we all go to the speed of light.
Yes, let's transform to the speed of light right now. Thank you. Good night.
Thanks, Pat and Tamara.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good to have you with us.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, and to turn it off, I go stop recording, pound, star 9, stop, stop, pound, stop. Hold on, hold on.